Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, some thought it would never happen. This past week, it did. Criminal charges against Israeli leaders at the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
The charges are indeed hugely significant. Starvation as a war crime, persecution as a crime against humanity, murder, extermination, genocide charges almost certainly will come at a later stage.
Israeli leaders can kiss their overseas travel plans goodbye.
Netanyahu doesn't buy a ticket on Ryanair and just show up at the airport one day in a country. He's the head of government, and so his visits are choreographed at the diplomatic level. I think what in practice will happen is that governments like those of Canada and Germany and France and so on, the United Kingdom, will say, don't come here. You can't come here because we have to arrest you.
And which does international law serve, power or justice? What difference does it make?
International law by itself will never liberate Palestine or deliver a two-state solution, but it will give strength to attempts by those who say either a two-state solution is what has to happen, or it's going to have to be a one-state democratic solution that relies upon the rule of law for all that live between the river and the sea.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. The wheels of justice turn slowly, nowhere more slowly than at the world's top international courts, where lawless, powerful states and their allies enjoy impunity, perhaps. No state commits crimes with more assured impunity than the state of Israel. Its unique dispensation to violate international law, no questions asked, may be crumbling. Last week in The Hague, the chief prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, British barrister Karim Khan, announced that he will be seeking arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for a host of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Among these, starvation as a weapon of war, willful killing and murder, extermination, and persecution. Reasonable grounds also exist for charging Yahya Sinwar, Hamas's leader inside Gaza, the commander-in-chief of Hamas's military wing, and Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas's political bureau, for a host of crimes committed since at least October 7th, Khan also announced. 4 days later, across town from the ICC, the international community's top judicial body, the International Court of Justice, ordered Israel to suspend its military operations in the southern Gazan city, Rafah, to open the Rafah crossing to humanitarian aid and to let international observers in to ensure that evidence of genocide is not destroyed. The ICJ ruling was issued in response to an ongoing case initiated by South Africa against Israel in January under the 1994 Genocide Convention. This was the fourth time South Africa asked the court to order Israel to halt its assault on Gaza. For Israel, last week's ICJ ruling was the latest twist in a slow-motion legal train wreck. Long accustomed to doing what it wants with impunity, Israeli leaders are now doubling down on their lawless acts, both in Gaza and the West Bank. To learn more about last week's landmark rulings at the ICC and ICJ in The Hague, the GPM reached out to three legal and human rights scholars. You'll hear Toby Cadman first. Cadman is a British barrister specializing in international criminal, human rights, and humanitarian law, and the founder of the Guernica Group. I reached Toby Cadman in London. Hello, Toby Cadman.
Good morning.
So it's the morning after this groundbreaking announcement from Karim Khan, chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, announcing applications for arrest warrants Did this come as a surprise for you?
No, not really. I think it didn't come as a surprise for two reasons. One, because of the inevitability of the nature and direction of the situation in Gaza, but also because it seems to have been the worst kept secret in The Hague. Everyone's been talking about it for the last two or three weeks as it's coming. Even Netanyahu and his government had announced, for the purpose of getting, I would say, friends to lobby on their behalf to prevent any arrest warrants. And then we saw the threat of action sanctions by members of the US Senate and Congress. And then, of course, we saw and heard Karim Khan's presentation at the UN Security Council. So I think that it was inevitable that it was coming. It was really just a question of time, a question of who, and a question of what. So now we have seen arrest warrants being requested for five individuals, three on the Hamas side, two from Israeli side, the Prime Minister and his Defense Minister. But I think that what is very clear to many of us who are watching this and have been actively monitoring the conflict is that this is probably just the very beginning.
How so, the very beginning? Are you suggesting, as Khan has, that there will be additional arrest warrants?
I think that's very clear. And I listened to Sir Geoffrey Nice yesterday, who's obviously a very seasoned international prosecutor, who had made the comment in an interview yesterday that the likelihood is that we're looking at probably weeks rather than months before warrants would be approved. And I, as he, see no reason why those warrants would not be approved. And then if we look at the report of the panel of experts that Karim Khan has, in my view, very sensibly turned to validate and to provide an objective view of his approach, they have made it very clear that there will be other individuals charged, probably from both sides.
Huh. I can think of a few Hamas members who might be charged, but I can imagine more Israelis, like the chief of staff. There's Benny Gantz, and then there are all these senior officials associated with Israel's settlement enterprise, which wasn't mentioned at all by Khan.
That's right. I think there's a lot that hasn't been said so far that we will probably see over the coming weeks and months. I mentioned particularly the National Security Minister, who has been particularly active. And again, more recently, just over the last few days. So I think the likelihood is that things will move relatively quickly. And I think that there will be more individuals. I mean, what I find particularly interesting is the nature of the allegations against the Israeli suspects. I think that Karim has chosen very carefully the charges that he seeks to bring against them. And I know that there has been some criticism that they haven't been charged with genocide or incitement to commit genocide. But I think when one looks at what they are actually charged with, they are certainly not insignificant charges. Starvation as a war crime, persecution as a crime against humanity, murder, extermination, and then what Karim Khan calls as the complete siege of Gaza. So I think that the charges are indeed hugely significant. And of course, Karim Khan also recognizes the challenges in bringing any charge of genocide as being the single most difficult charge to bring. And of course, I would imagine that there has to be a determination as to whether, you know, what the International Court of Justice is doing distinct from the International Criminal Court, and also whether the judges, the pretrial judges, would readily issue arrest warrants for a charge of genocide at this time. So I'm not overly concerned that that hasn't been charged at this stage. I think that charges will come. Genocide charges almost certainly will come at a later stage. But I think that this is a very good starting point. Now, what may have happened is that these applications, these requests for arrest warrants, have been unsealed, but there may be other arrest warrants that still remain sealed or that may be subject to future requests. I mean, the one thing that we have to put in mind here is that the International Criminal Court is, of course, a court with limited finite resources. And so we're not going to see 100 people charged by the ICC. We're probably going to see a handful, no more than a dozen, I wouldn't have thought. And again, of course, that doesn't prevent other countries through charging individuals through universal jurisdiction who are potentially lower down the command chain. But I think that there's still a lot of work to be done, and a lot of work will be done.
Segueing from your comment about the court's limited financial resources, I'm wondering if you see yesterday's announcement and the pursuit of arrest warrants against Israeli leaders and Hamas leaders as strengthening the court as the world's preeminent permanent venue for criminal prosecutions, or is this now a potential liability for the court? And most notably in the wake of comments from the United States, Biden called this outrageous. U.S. legislators on both sides of the aisle are calling for sanctions against the ICC and Karim Khan. And I was just reading in the U.K., of course, U.K. Deputy Foreign Secretary Andrew Mitchell referred to Khan's announcement as repugnant to have made moral equivalence between Hamas and the Israelis, unworthy and ludicrous comparison. So the Germans, moderately supportive, but also kind of very disturbed. The French, perhaps a little more supportive. But I think particularly about the shockwaves coming, blowback from the United States. So does this build the ICC as an institution, or is it a potential liability?
I think it's a very interesting question. I think there are two points that I would raise. First of all, I have said, many of us have said, that what the international community does as a result of this and does from now will effectively determine the extent to which international law applies in the future. Karim Khan said very clearly yesterday at his press conference was that nobody is immune from prosecution. He has put individuals on notice as to the jurisdiction of his office and has told them if they do not respect the customs of war, they have to face the consequences. And so it was very important for him to hold true on that promise. So I think from one position, it has demonstrated that international law and our notions of justice and accountability, bringing an end to impunity, exists. And I think for many of us who are starting to become a little bit concerned that it is okay for us to pursue crimes committed, atrocity crimes committed around the world, except for Israel, has now shown us that even Israeli political and military officials are not immune from prosecution. If they commit crimes, they will be prosecuted. As to whether this will help or hinder the International Criminal Court, I think it has, I would say, in one move, solidified the independence of the institution and the relevance of the institution.
This is the very first time that the International Criminal Court has sought arrest warrants against Western leaders of a Western country, Israel being a Western country, like they were initially tried to do something vis-a-vis Afghanistan, and American officials were implicated, but that got shot down pretty quickly. So never before has the ICC done this.
That's right. And I think that is significant. In terms of the response from the US in particular, I think it is appalling the approach that's been taken. I think referring to this as repugnant and outrageous and making threats towards Karim Khan and his staff, and in fact, even his family, that they will not be able to travel to the United States, I think that is repugnant and that is outrageous. Now, if you were to compare what President Biden said when the announcement was made as to the arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin, which was lauded as a huge moment. And the United States, for the first time, started to actively support the work of the International Criminal Court, providing it with additional funding, providing it with resources, and providing it with assistance. That was a pivotal moment, in my mind, in Biden's administration, in supporting a relevant institution of justice. Contrast that with what was said yesterday. It would appear that it does not matter what the current Israeli government does, it will never face any criticism from a US administration. And that is very, very worrying. And I think it's worrying because what the US needs to understand, it's not necessarily what it says on this particular issue, it's the message that it sends to other states as to their notion of a transparent process of justice and accountability. You know, we should be looking at some more rogue or dictatorial states that will look to the US as, well, look, if they're not supporting this, if they're attacking this, if they're making threats towards this institution, what is preventing us from doing that? So I think it does widen the gap of impunity when a state such as the United States takes a very, very contrasting position between two very similar conflicts.
President Biden, Antony Blinken, and others, I suppose, in the UK say that this is going to make achieving a peaceful resolution to the situation in Gaza more difficult. Do you have an opinion on this, Toby Cadman? Do you see the pursuit of arrest warrants as hindering or hastening resolution to the conflict? And is this even an issue? Should it be an issue for the chief prosecutor?
I mean, what peace process is there? There is no peace process. So to say that we cannot pursue justice because that's going to interfere with a peaceful resolution, you cannot have peace without justice and accountability. We know that through our history, that if you fail to recognize the importance of holding perpetrators of atrocity crimes accountable, there can be no peaceful resolution. And let's not kid ourselves that whilst we're looking at 7th of October onwards, it is certainly not where it started. We have a system of apartheid, the clearest example of apartheid. We have seen the total destruction of Gaza. We have seen the intentional targeting of civilians, all in the name of targeting Hamas terrorist leaders. Now, we have seen more recently, not more recently, but consistently, but we're seeing it again, attacks by settlers in the West Bank. So all of these matters need to be properly addressed.
What will be Karim Khan's next step once the first trial chamber approves the arrest warrants?
Well, then he's going to request that the individuals surrender, which, of course, we have to expect that will not be followed. He will then have to seek ways in which these individuals can be arrested. He will be seeking the active support of state parties that if any of these individuals enter territories of countries which are state parties to the Rome Statute, that they are arrested and handed over to the ICC, and his investigations will continue. I mean, obviously, the arrest warrants is just the very beginning of the process.
And this could be really difficult. I mean, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, I'm not sure how often they travel to Germany or France or the UK, not all that often. But I can imagine all these other, senior and not so senior, but culpable Israeli military officers and officials who have not yet been named, but figure they may be in the ICC's sights, who travel to Europe more frequently, perhaps regularly, and are really going to be thinking twice before they do that.
Well, that's right. And of course, the very states that criticize South Africa for not arresting al-Bashir when he traveled there will have to act very carefully if any of the suspects enter their territory. So, for example, if either of the Israeli leaders enter any European country that had previously been critical of South Africa for not arresting al-Bashir, it's going to be slightly hypocritical if they decide not to take any action here. I think what we'll probably see is there will be a great deal of noise made by some of those states, but they will probably try and persuade the prime minister and his defense minister to not travel to those countries because they know that they would be obligated to arrest them. Even if Netanyahu is not arrested, he will go down in history as a head of state against whom an arrest warrant has been issued and potentially indicted. And those head of states that have been subject to the same, I mean, that's not the company which he would want to be amongst. And of course, it will have a very serious impact on his future, whether as prime minister or not. And we all know that he has his own domestic problems distinct from the attack on Gaza. And of course, he's not going to be in office forever. And he's not going to have the protection of his supporting states forever. And there is a possibility. And as we know, we look at some world leaders who have faced prosecution, particularly when their term of office ends. And so it is a very precarious situation for him to be in. And I think he is rightly concerned that this is a process upon which he could find himself in The Hague.
Toby Cadman is a British barrister specializing in international criminal, human rights, and humanitarian law. He's the co-founder of the Guernica Group and joint head of chambers at Guernica 37 International Justice Chambers in London. To learn more about Karim Khan's applications for arrest warrants against Israeli and Hamas leaders at the ICC, what Khan's applications say and what they don't, the GPM reached out to Canadian legal scholar William Shabas. Khan's application is as noteworthy for what it doesn't say as for what it does say. It makes no mention of genocide, it makes no mention of apartheid, and it makes no reference to Israel's settlement enterprise, which has to be, you know, amongst all of Israel's various transgressions, none are as long-standing, as systematic, institutionalized, and well-documented as its settlement enterprise, which constitutes a war crime under the Rome Statute. So what are your thoughts on the absence of genocide, apartheid, and the settlement enterprise in Khan's application?
I think it's quite normal for an application of this nature for an arrest warrant to focus on particular issues. And I think this is a fact of international criminal prosecution. We can go back to Nuremberg to see examples of things that were left out of the indictment at Nuremberg. I have for many years felt that the settlements was an issue that was particularly clear and where it would be impossible for Israel to invoke what's called complementarity and argue that it was investigating the crime, because this is obviously an act that's conducted as pursuant to legislation and as part of government policy.
Complementarity, for those who don't know much about international law, complementarity being this idea that arrest warrants or pursue court action if the country itself is unable or unwilling to do so itself.
Yes, it's being deferential towards the national justice system, and it's a way that a state or an individual accused can fight off a charge and an arrest warrant, for example, or a trial. They can resist it, the exercise of jurisdiction by the court, on the ground that the state is willing, able to prosecute the case. But that being said, this was more of a practical choice. We can prepare a long, long list of grievances relating to Israel. And in this case, the prosecutors decided to focus on the ones relating to the conflict over the last 7-8 months, and in particular, the issue of starvation, which has become particularly acute and of great importance at present, as confirmed by the fact that the issue was also being debated before the International Court of Justice.
So do you suspect, Bill Shabas, that the Khan has additional arrest warrants up his sleeve, perhaps even under seal, that he's just waiting, poised to see what the pretrial chamber says, testing the waters, let the pretrial chamber approve his first two prosecutions, and, you know, plus Hamas is three.
He said as much in his statement. He said that this is not the end of it. So what exactly he's looking at, whether he's going to continue with this procedure of consultation with outside experts, I don't know. We don't know what he's going to do. This is a matter that is within his gift, within his discretion, and he'll decide.
What do you make of the differential way in which Khan writes about Israeli victims of October 7th attacks? Specifically, I saw the devastating scenes of these attacks and the profound impact of the unconscionable crimes. I heard how the love within a family, the deepest bonds between a parent and a child, expressing his gratitude to the survivors of October 7th. But nothing, not even a whisper of sympathy of this sort towards Gazan victims of Israeli violence. What do you make of this? Is it just trivial, or is there something to conclude about Khan's perhaps political approach to this?
It's characteristic of a lot of the discussion of the ongoing conflict, and he sort of reflects something that's quite common, is this outpouring of great sympathy for the Israeli victims and, shall we just say, less visible and not an equivalent concern for the Palestinians. I think it's also true in the way people talk about the violence of the 7th of October, where it's used, you know, there are adjectives that are attached to it, like horrific, or, you know, it's become actually impossible to talk about the subject without, at least from, I'm talking about Western journalists, Western politicians, framing it as if in some way this is the what happened on the 7th of October is the crime of the century. And they don't use the same terms when they talk about the subsequent events in Gaza. I guess public opinion, it's pretty obvious for everyone to see that on the 7th of October, there were about 1,000 Israelis who were killed. Probably 400 of them were combatants. They were soldiers and police. It seems that a significant number were killed by friendly fire. Perhaps Israel was applying what they call the Hannibal Directive, where they are prepared to take the lives of their own people in order to prevent hostages being taken, the Hannibal Directive, possibly. That's been alleged. And of course, we also know that on the 7th of October, the casualties of the children were really quite small, 20, something like this, 20, 25 children were killed, which is, of course, a horrible number, but it doesn't compare with the 15,000 Palestinian children who have been killed. Yeah, a large part of that, I think, also is anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian racism, because the acts of the 7th of October are being treated as if they were somehow the work of barbarians, of savages, and so on, whereas the absolute destruction of Gaza is being written off as, you know, acts of self-defense that got out of control, something like that, which obviously doesn't describe them.
Now, if the pretrial chamber approves Karim Khan's application for arrest warrants and the arrest warrants are issued, what position does this place signatories to the Rome Statute in? And it's interesting that a German government spokesman has just said, sure, if arrest warrants are issued, we'll execute those arrest warrants. We'll execute an arrest warrant against Benjamin Netanyahu or Gallant if they appear on German soil. This is normal, but it's kind of, again, it's a bit astonishing. Your thoughts on this? Like, does this really place governments like Canada, obligate them to say, yes, we'll execute arrest warrants?
Well, yes, of course. I think that they will do this if required. I think that the likelihood that, you know, I mean, Netanyahu doesn't buy a ticket on Ryanair and just show up at the airport one day in a country. He's the head of government, and so his visits are choreographed at the diplomatic level. I think what in practice will happen is that governments like those of Canada and Germany and France and so on, the United Kingdom, will say, don't come here. You can't come here because we have to arrest you. But that's not dishonoring their obligations under the treaty. That's just saying this is the law and we're going to respect it. And it would be a confirmation of the effectiveness of the Rome Statute. And if I were Netanyahu and a state